So when we were doing mitzvos earlier, so basically we skipped from the mitzvah of sanctifying the new moon, the Jewish months, to the Ten Commandments, I think was what we did, we skipped. But everything in the middle, more or less, is relevant to Pesach, to the Exodus, to the Seder. So then I want to go back and revisit those, because that time of year, and we could both approach it from the perspective of being a mitzvah and also understand more about Pesach itself, as Pesach approaches. So it's important to understand, I think, number one, that the way we experience a Yom Tov nowadays is very different than the way they used to in the times of the Beis HaMikdash. Because in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, there was a mitzvah three times a year to make Aliyah L'Regel, that every Jew should go to the Beis HaMikdash itself on the holiday. We were a major part of the service of a holiday's sacrifices, which we don't experience. We have no relationship to that, basically. It was a unifying force because everybody gathered in the same area. So instead of people, you know, going to their friends and family and this and that for Yantif, they would all gather in Jerusalem. That's where they would gather. And Yantif was a whole different experience than we can even imagine. Our picture of Yantif nowadays is a totally different thing. Karban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, was the centerpiece of Pesach, more or less. This was one sacrifice that every single Jew was obligated to bring individually. Maybe joining groups. So I'm saying everyone had their own personal obligation to bring the sacrifice, men and women. And it was all sacrificed on one day, on Erev Pesach, in the afternoon. So it was an extremely busy day in the Beis HaMikdash. All the Kohanim were on duty. We'll talk about the process of bringing the Karban Pesach. But the experience, the scene, is a scene which we can't even imagine. What it means to have every Jew in Jerusalem, every Jew bringing a sacrifice on the same day. You know, in the afternoon. So it's a very limited amount of time to bring the sacrifice. And I would say that if somebody from that time saw our Pesach, it would be foreign to them. They wouldn't know what we were doing. Because for them, the holiday was the sacrificial service, the holiday was gathering in Jerusalem. If somebody walked into our dining rooms here in Maryland in 2012, somebody came out of that world and saw us, it would be strange, it would be alien. They would have pity on us that we're lacking the inspiration that they had, and they wouldn't even know what we're doing. The rituals we have would be so different than what they were used to. There'd be a disconnect. For us, we're not used to that. For us, the sacrificial service seems to be totally beyond us, so we can't relate to that. But it goes both ways. We have to understand that the Torah's image of a holiday is a very different image than that which we have in our minds of a holiday. So unfortunately,
Hey, how are you?
What a surprise.
Unfortunately, I've got time.
Sorry to get here earlier. It's fine, happy to have you back. Okay, so the image of a holiday is totally different from their time to our time, but I want to just sort of paint the picture of the Karban Pesach, what it was like.
What's that word again?
Karban's a sacrifice.
Karban, okay.
So yeah, Karban Pesach. Pesach sacrifice. I want to paint the image of that Karban Pesach and understand what the sacrifice was, some of the rules of the sacrifice, and from that we can gain lessons. There's a lot of lessons that are contained within the sacrifice. So based on my count, there are 9 separate mitzvahs that are relevant to the sacrifice. I'll quickly list them, and then maybe we'll talk about a few of them more in depth. There's a mitzvah to slaughter the sacrifice. There's a mitzvah to eat the meat of the sacrifice. There is a mitzvah that you're not allowed to eat it cooked, only roasted. When I say cooked, I mean in liquid. It has to be roasted. The Pesach sacrifice. You're not allowed to leave over from it until the morning to finish all the meat that night, at Seder night. So you have to make sure your group is big enough you can actually finish up all the meat. You're not allowed to feed it to a Jew who's an apostate, a Jew who started worshipping idols or cast off the religion. A non-Jew is not allowed to partake of it. Once you start eating it, you can't bring the meat out of the area from which you're eating. So if you're eating in a house, the meat has to stay in that room. You can't take it out of the room. You can't break the bones of the sacrifice.
Can't break the what?
The bones. You can't break the bones. And an uncircumcised Jew can't partake of it either. A male, obviously. The female, obviously, good. But an uncircumcised male Jew cannot partake of the sacrifice. So those are 9 separate Torah mitzvahs that are relevant to the sacrifice. So you have to understand there's a law, there's always a message behind the law. What's the message here behind all these different rules that we can take from the kind of sacrifice? Let's go through the basics of it, and then we'll try to understand how it's relevant to us nowadays, even though we can't bring the sacrifice. We don't have the Holy Temple, we don't bring sacrifices nowadays, but we have to understand what's the message to us. just the basics, Karban Pesach ABCs. What are the basics? The sacrifice was either a lamb or a goat. That's number one. It was a lamb or a goat. There's a unique rule about the sacrifice that everyone had to make groups beforehand. You couldn't just pop in on your friends on Pesach night and join in on the sacrifice. You had to appoint groups beforehand. You're not allowed to eat from the Karban Pesach unless you were already appointed to a group. So usually, I guess it would be in family units, but also you might have neighbors, friends as well, because you have to finish all the meat that night. So you can't have a small group. You have to have a large group.
They
what?
Had to pay ahead of time.
Yeah, people pay. Yeah, people would purchase their portion as well. That's part of it. It was slaughtered in the courtyard of the temple on the 14th of Nisan, which is Erev Pesach. So picture how Erev Pesach is nowadays. Everybody's scrambling to get their seder ready and finishing the preparation of their house. They had to already be at the temple with their sacrifice ready to go on Erev Pesach. The slaughtering happened in three separate groups. So there would be, it's like three seedings, you know, there are three separate groups here. And they would have, one group would go in, they would, as they were slaughtering the sacrifice, the Levites would be singing Hallel. They would be blowing, there's a certain routine of blowing the shofar that they would do as well as they were slaughtering the sacrifices. And then that group would leave, the next group would come in. There are three different groups. And they bring in their sacrifices. Again, all the Kohanim were on duty. This is the busiest day of the year in the temple. So every Kohen had to be there working. No question about it. So if we can't even picture the scene of what it would be like. Every single Jew in the world there, everybody there with their sacrifice at their side, bringing it in, having it slaughtered. Then you would take the meat back home. I mean, wherever you're staying, at least for the Antif, if your home is far, you would stay in Jerusalem. If you take the meat and you would roast it, you would eat it in Jerusalem. But you couldn't even take it out of Jerusalem. The truth is, you have to eat the meat in Jerusalem. So you cannot take this meat home if you lived outside Jerusalem. You'd have to be in a hotel or something.
I can't imagine the logistics on this.
Yeah.
Right.
Two weeks in Jerusalem or
hard enough.
Two weeks in Jerusalem.
The Mishnah says it was a miracle that there was enough space for everybody. People didn't complain in enough space. So one of the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, it says one of the 10 miracles that happened constantly in Jerusalem was that nobody ever complained due to lack of space. So the cute way of understanding it is there was no complaints. You know, there was lack of space, no one complained. That's the cute way of understanding it. But a simple way is that there's actually enough space for everybody. But having Jews together, not complaining, is also a miracle. So it's pretty miraculous.
You can think about the 21st century, you don't know how it was back then.
In terms of what?
Jews
complaining.
Yes.
Oh, okay, that's true.
Stiff-necked in the Bible.
It's a good point. Very good point. We were always stubborn and stiff-necked in the first place.
Complained about meat in the desert.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So I guess complaints are do predate modern Judaism. Eating was done at the night of the 15th at your seder. So at your seder, your meat for the seder would be this meat of the Karban Pesach.
The 15th.
On the 15th, it's the night of the 15th of Nisan.
So the sacrifice is on the afternoon.
It was in the afternoon of the 14th. Remember that Jewish days start at the night. So the 14th in the afternoon was the sacrifice was actually slaughtered. And that night, which would be the 15th.
No, it would be the 14th.
No, because at sundown it switches.
Oh, at sundown it switches.
Yeah, sundown it goes to the next day on the Jewish calendar.
My day starts, you know.
Yeah, right. Right. The Jewish calendar, so the sundown hits, it switches. Right. Now it's the 15th. So on the 15th, you would, at night, at your Seder, you would eat the meat of the Karban Pesach. The rule was you had to eat the meat, it's called al-hasova. It should be at the end of your meal. You should already be full as you start eating the meat. You shouldn't have it in the beginning of the meal. So people who had, let's say, smaller groups, they might eat a little bit and then eat the karban. If you had larger groups, there was less meat to eat, you might have a full meal prior. The karban would be your dessert, basically. It would be at the end of the meal. That was the rule. The mitzvah of eating matzah and maror initially was along with the meat. So technically, it would be kind of like a sandwich. You'd have like your matzah, you would have your lamb chops, and you would have your maror on top, and you'd eat it all together. Which we try to remember at the Seder by when we have the sandwich combining the matzah and the maror together. And the truth is, matzah back then wasn't as crisp and crunchy like ours is. If you ever see, like, even nowadays, if you ever see like a Yemenite matzah, theirs kind of looks like a pita, like a laffa. So you kind of picture like a shawarma here. It's kind of like a pita with lamb inside and some lettuce or some horseradish inside. That was your Karban Pesach.
So, I'm sorry.
Our matzah is...
Sorry, Rabbi. So it was the matzah of those days, the sacrifice, and then the rest of the Seder plate?
The maror you would eat, the bitter herbs you put in there. Right.
Okay. Was that the whole wheat grain instead, or was it white?
I'm not sure. I think it may have been white, because the way the Gemara seems to imply that nobody liked eating whole wheat back then. So, but I don't think it would matter if it was whole wheat or white. But I mean, nowadays we've become very, very strict on matzahs because we have so many doubts and we don't trust ourselves. So we make them flat and crunchy, poke holes in them, make sure it gets totally baked through. There's no question at all of them being chametz. But there are many Sephardim, especially the Yemenites, their matzahs actually are more pita-like. Even nowadays, you go to Israel and look at the Yemenite matzahs. You don't see them much in America. Well, as long as you cook it fast enough. 18 minutes is the cutoff. If you get it into the oven fast enough, it doesn't have to be crispy. Our Ashkenazic custom is to make them crispy just because we're scared. So we want to cook them all the way through and make them thin and crispy.
Air on the side of fashion.
Exactly. But the people don't have that custom, such as certain groups of Sephardim, so their matzahs, as long as you get it into the oven cooked by 18 minutes, you're set. So you can make a pita that way. You can just pour our flour together, stick it in. You don't have to flatten it out and make it into a crunchy cracker. So our custom is to do that, but that's not... So back then, before we became so stringent with these matzahs, it probably didn't resemble more like a pita or a latke rather than a cracker, like we have.
The 18 minutes, is that to get it in the oven or to take it out of the oven?
To get it fully baked.
So coming out of the oven, it has to be out of the oven?
Right, I think so, yeah. I think so. I've never been to a matzah bakery. I really wanted to go to one
I thought it was
to
get it into the oven.
Right? The kids go to like the pretend, they're kind of pretend matzah bakeries, right? I want to go see a real one though. They have real ones you can visit in Brooklyn and Lakewood and places like that. But I'm pretty sure it's the out 18 minutes because you want it to be cooked because if it's not cooked, it's still rising. You want to get it cooked so it stops rising. So I think it's 18 minutes is your deadline for getting it cooked, I think. But I've never been to matzah bakery. I'm not 100% sure about that. The mitzvah was to eat at least a kazayas, an olive-sized piece of the meat of the karbon. But again, you have to finish it all. So if you have a large group, so everyone takes their one kazayas and they're set. If you have a small group, you may have to eat some large lamb chops there to finish it all off. This isn't so bad. Like we said, you can't break the bones. It has to be fully roasted. It can't be cooked in any liquid. And you can't leave the house, and you can't have the meat leave the house as you're involved in eating the karbon. So that's just the basics of how it was done. The mitzvah of the Karban Pesach is considered a very significant mitzvah. It's compared with Bris Milah in that it's part of the covenant between us and God. The Karban Pesach is one of the two positive commandments that incurs the very severe penalty of Kares. It's called spiritual incision, I guess is the exact translation. But it's a very severe spiritual punishment called Kares. The Torah allots that for many severe sins. The only two positive commands that incur that punishment are if a man dies without a circumcision, or if somebody neglects the Karban Pesach. So those two are considered very, very primary mitzvahs in Jewish life. It's kind of like your entrance card into the club in a certain way. Those two mitzvahs. Unfortunately, we can't do it, right? But if there's a temple, that's how. So for us, we're stuck. So God's not. We're not punished for that because it's a coercion. We can't do anything about it. That's how it is. But it is considered a very significant mitzvah. It's performed by Jews on the night of the Exodus. The night of the Exodus is the night of our freedom, where we became a people. That's where God chose us as his people with a special mission. So the way we mark that night primarily is with this karban, with this sacrifice. And it was obligated through history, throughout history, at all times where we had a temple, we had to bring this karban. So that's the basics of it. And I want to try to go into the symbolism behind it. Because the basics, unfortunately, we can't accomplish nowadays. We can't actually bring this karban. But what's the message the karban has for us? Because the message does apply to our Seder, applies to our Pesach, applies to our lives. So there's three different messages I'd like to draw out from the karban Pesach. From three different sources. We'll go from the most basic to, the deeper approach. So the most basic approach is the approach of the Rambam, Maimonides. And he usually takes a very logical, intellectual approach to mitzvahs. That's what he's known for. He discusses the mitzvah of Karban Pesach in his book Mor Nevuchim in the Guide for the Perplexed, as they translate in English. The Guide for the Perplexed. And he says there that, and you have sources for this throughout the Torah, that the Egyptians used to worship livestock. They'd worship sheep, they'd worship lambs. That's part of the world of paganism, worshiping animals is a very common thing. Even nowadays, the Hindus feel that I think cows are considered special animals, and that they won't kill a cow or eat a cow, I think. But it's considered a very, in the ancient world, worshipping animals is a very, very widespread practice. So the Egyptians would not eat sheep. They would not eat lamb. It's actually a verse you find in the book of Bereishis. It says in the book of Bereishis, when Yosef's brothers came to see him in Egypt, they didn't realize who he was. He was posing as an Egyptian minister. And the Torah says that when they sat down for a meal, that they gave food for Yosef by himself, and for the brothers by themselves, and for the Egyptians by themselves. So they basically had three different selections of food happening at this meal. They had Yosef's food, they had the brothers' food, and they had the Egyptians' food. And it says, why? Because the Egyptians would not eat with the Hebrews, because it was an abomination for them to eat with the Hebrews. So why was it an abomination? So the Targum Unkus, that's the original Aramaic translation of the Torah, which is considered an authoritative source, he explains that it's because since Jews would eat the animals which the Egyptians worshipped, the Egyptians wouldn't sit in a meal with them. So the Hebrews had to sit on their own, they couldn't eat with the Egyptians. That's why they sat them down and gave them separate food at separate tables, it sounds like. So based on that, the Rambam says that since this was such a widespread practice to worship sheep, worship lambs, and Pesach is a time where the Jews were chosen to be the people that represents the one and only God, and they're supposed to bring monotheism to the world. So we have to publicly display that we reject these pagan practices, and we accept only one God. So we take their God, and we slaughter it. That's what we do, and we eat it. For the sake of our God, for the sake of the real God. And in the times in Egypt itself, they actually took the blood, they put it on the doorpost, and they publicly displayed, look, we're taking your God, we're wiping his blood on our doorpost. They actually had it, right?
Some God that is.
Yeah, right, exactly. That was the point. Exactly the point.
It protected us from the angel of death.
No, that was fun. I'm saying that we killed
him. Yeah, we killed him and smeared the blood on our doorposts. And it was a miracle that the Egyptians couldn't even retaliate. We were there, we took their gods, and we were abusing their gods. And miraculously, they did not retaliate against us. They were too scared. The plagues had already brought them down to their knees, and that was it. But that was all part of the scene in Egypt, and we continue that scene for all generations to show that we reject pagan practices, we reject the worship of animals, and we only worship the one and only God. You have a question, Judy?
Yeah, is that where the mezuzah comes from? Is that whole concept?
Wait, what?
You know, they put it on a doorpost. I wonder if the mezuzah concept comes from...
A mezuzah. It's a separate command of the Torah. The Torah isn't really linked to it together, so I don't know if there's a connection or not. It's interesting to think about. But the Torah does not link the mitzvah of putting up the mezuzah with this blood on the doorpost. You don't see any connection, from what I know.
Did you mean like a protection of the house to have the mezuzah there to remind you of that?
Yeah, because they passed over all the houses, so I thought maybe there was a reason for the doorpost. You know?
Right. I mean, it definitely sounds like there should be a connection. I'm not aware of a connection, but it's an interesting thing to think about, to research a little bit, maybe. So we're displaying the contrast between paganism and faith in God. That's what we're doing. So the commentaries explain, based on this, why we have to roast it, why can't we boil it? Because roasting, the smell spreads more when you roast. The aroma of the meat roasting, you walk by a barbecue, you smell it throughout the whole neighborhood. The aroma of roasting is a much more powerful aroma than that. If you're to boil meat, the smell does not permeate the house in the same way. When you roast meat, it spreads a lot more. So we're trying to publicly display that we reject their practices, and we accept only the one and only God, so we really want to publicize it. And this is why the meat is not appropriate for non-Jew to eat. It's not appropriate for a Jew who's rejected Judaism to eat, because we're trying to profess our belief in the one and only God, and these are people who haven't accepted that quite yet. Either the Jew rejected it or the Goy hasn't accepted it, so therefore they can't eat of this carbon. The other point which comes with this, the Rambam explains, is that every year of Pesach, one of the fundamental principles of the Seder is to reenact the Exodus. We say in the Seder that every year we should view ourselves as if we left Egypt. That's part of our Seder routine. So part of reenacting the Exodus, the Torah tells us, at the time of the Exodus, they left Egypt in a haste. Bechipazona, it's called in Hebrew. That the time came to leave and they were rushed out. Which is why the Torah says their bread didn't rise, because they're rushing out. There's no time for the bread to rise. They had to bake it as it was and carry it on their backs. So a lot of the practices we have in the Karban Pesach are reminiscent of the speed in which they left. So for instance, not breaking the bones, as one example. If you spend time to break the bones and suck out every single morsel of meat inside the bone, that takes time. If you're in a rush, you just eat it and run. You don't start like trying to suck off the extra scraps of the meat. The fact you can't take the meat out of your house. when you have plenty of time, so you might send meat to others. You might, you know, package something, bring it to a friend. Maybe you'll walk outside, have a snack or something. If you're in a rush, you sit down, eat, and you go. There's no thinking meat anywhere. So that'll suggest the idea of rushing. Some point out that even...
Two rush,
right. Because they're rushed out of Egypt. That's what we're trying to remember, that they're rushed out of Egypt. The roasting meat roasts quicker than it boils. So roasting also a type of speeding up the process. It's reminiscent of the speed in which they left Egypt. The fact we roast them, even don't boil the meat. So that's all part of reenacting the Exodus. That's what all those different halachas represent. Yeah?
What about reclining?
That's actually a different aspect of the Seder, which we'll talk about in a minute, actually. But the reclining itself is a rabbinic command. That's not a Torah command. But it ties in with the next symbolism we'll discuss with the Karban. And even getting into groups. Having groups means we're not waiting for the last minute. We're going to get everything organized beforehand so we can go as fast as possible once the time comes. You know, if you're one of those people who waits for the last minute, and you call, hey, can I join you? You know, so that usually takes a little slower. You're not organized. Being arranged in groups beforehand suggests the idea of being organized, being quick, ready to go. That's what it suggests. So all these ideas suggesting the speed in which they left Egypt. So this is all quoted from the Rambam. So two ideas in the Rambam. Number one, we're professing our belief in God as opposed to paganism, which worshipped animals. And also we're trying to reenact the speed of the Exodus by doing things which speed up the process of preparing and eating this meat. That's the Rambam. Now, to take it one step deeper, we have the explanation of the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch is one of the primary books that goes through mitzvahs and their meaning and what the symbolism of the mitzvahs are. So Sefer HaChinuch describes, and there's a theme overall on Pesach night, and this is what Stan's alluding to, which is that on the Seder night, we try to act as royalty. We try to display the fact that we are free people, that God has chosen us, we're special, we have a mission, we have something to really celebrate and to enjoy. That's what we try to symbolize Pesach night. So reclining as we eat is part of that. When you recline as you eat, you're taking it easy, you're acting like royalty. The idea of having four cups of wine, some say, also suggests royalty. You sit around, enjoy your wine. There's a lot of things with the Seder. You're supposed to bring out your finest dishes at the Seder. Obviously, most of us probably our finest dishes for the year, not for Pesach. But technically at the Seder, we should bring out our finest dishes possible. Make it look like a royal dinner. Because we are royalty. God selected us to be his people. He freed us. We're noble. That's part of the whole message of the Seder itself. We're like kings and queens. So the Sefer HaChinuch describes that the idea of roasting meat, which I guess is debatable, but he says that it's the way of kings to have roasted meat because it's more tasty. He says that cooked meat is more filling. So if you're poor, you want to cook your meat so it fills you up more. If you're wealthy, you want to roast the meat because it's more tasty, even though it's not as filling, but it's more tasty. I'm not sure exactly if we can relate to that or not. That's what he describes. But he also says the reason you can't have any leftovers is for this purpose. He says you can't leave over the meat till the morning. That's one of the mitzvahs about the Karban Pesach. Why not? Because if you are a royalty, you don't need leftovers. You eat what you have. If you don't finish it, you'll give it to your servants or toss it in the trash can. You're not going to have leftovers the next day. So the mitzvah of not leaving over from the Karban Pesach suggests royalty. We want to finish up our food, and we don't leave it, there's no leftovers till tomorrow. The idea of not removing it from our homes. So if you're royalty also, you sit down for your meal in your royal hall, you enjoy your food, you don't take it with you on the road. That's not dignified for someone who's for a king to walk around, you know, eating their food. And you don't need to send to your friends either. The Sefer HaChinuch says that sometimes we have like a really good portion of food. We get a really good chocolate. We want to share it with our friends. If you're a wealthy king, your friends have all the food that you have. They're not excited by your food because they have the same thing. If you're a normal person, so then you get a nice piece of chocolate. You want to show your friends a piece of chocolate. You want to share it with them. He says, but royalty, they eat their food. Everyone has the same food because everyone's wealthy. And they can hire the same exact chef to make the same exact thing. So there's no sharing of food. So taking the food out of the house is also, it's not a dignified thing if you're acting as royalty. The idea of not breaking the bones. Again, if you're someone who's breaking away at the bones, sucking out every single morsel of meat, that's not a dignified practice for a king. A king will eat what he can, and you know, he has enough money and enough food to leave over, not have to suck away at bones and break bones and to chew off every single piece of meat he can find. So to remain dignified at the Seder, so we act like royalty, so we're not going to break the bones. The So it's a whole message that we're supposed to eat and act like nobility, like royalty at a Seder. We should act like we are freed and noble people. So the message behind this, so we don't have the Karam Pesach. There are practices we do have, the act of royalty that we mentioned, like reclining, like bringing out our nicest dishes, like drinking cups of wine, things like this, which do suggest royal practices. But there's a very powerful message here, is that we are the chosen people. God gave us a special mission in the world. God refers to us in the Torah as my firstborn son. That's what he calls the whole Jewish people. You're my firstborn son. We are God's child. And therefore, we do something to... We are special. We are dignified. We are unique. We are noble. That's who we are. So we may forget about that all year long. But on Pesach, the night where God took us out of Egypt, he freed us, he made us his people, that's the night we have to remember this idea. We have to understand that we are God's chosen people. We have a special mission in the world. We are royalty. There's a quote in the Gemara, which is actually used halachically. And the quote is that every single Jew is a ben melech. All Jews are princes and princesses. That's the Gemara actually has that quote. Rabbi Shimon says it in the Gemara. But there's a message to that, which is that we have to view ourselves as significant, as special. So we have a special mission from God, which no one else has. So the night of Pesach is when God conferred this status upon us, and therefore we have to remember that. So we sit around in our Seder, so if we have our karbon, we eat the karbon like royalty. Without the sacrifice, so we still act like royalty, and we should try to make our Seder a royal night, and make ourselves feel special, and wealthy, and noble. That's how we should feel at the Seder. We should feel the significance and the uniqueness of being a Jew, what it means to be a Jew. So that's the second level of symbolism which you have from Sefer HaChinuch. So the Rambam told us we're trying to reject the pagan practices. Sefer HaChinuch tells us that we're trying to act like royalty. There's one more, a deeper approach, which is from the Maharal. Maharal is known to take very deep approaches to Torah and to mitzvahs. He always has something which is a little bit more philosophical, but a deeper approach to Torah. So the Maharal describes that everything about this karban alludes to unity. Unity of God, unity of the Jewish people. And let's just give a preface to that. The tenet of Judaism is that there's one God and God is one. We say it in Shema Hashem Echad. Hashem is one. That's really our national anthem. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem is our God, Hashem is one. And that's what we stand for, that's who we are. And in the same vein, we're supposed to understand that as Jews who represent God, we have to be one. The problems throughout Jewish history all stem from our lack of unity, which is still a problem to this very day. But the ideal image of the Jewish people is that we have brotherhood, we are unified, and we represent the one God. If you have factions amongst the Jews, so that creates an image of different wills of God out there. There are different factions of God. If God's people is split, then that kind of splits up God. In a certain sense. So we have to be one and God is one. The ideal state of the Jews we had at Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, the Torah tells us they came, that they came there as one unified people. When we received the Torah, there was one God giving it to one unified people. Unfortunately, since then, there's been a lot of breakoffs and arguments and problems, and we still suffer from those to this very day. But we started off, and we should end up, and we should try always to unify the Jewish people and become one. That's our goal. So when we have unity, so then God's divine light can reflect off of us and be brought to the world as one. When we're fractured, so then God's light becomes fractured as well. We're supposed to represent God as one people, and when it doesn't happen, so that's when tragedy and that's when terrible things happen in the world. So every part of the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach suggests this concept of God being one and the Jews being one. Let's go through them. When you roast something, when you cook something in water, usually it starts breaking apart. Pieces start coming off of it. It gets fractured. When you barbecue something, it hardens. It becomes one. Pieces don't start falling off of it. It remains one piece. That's the idea of oneness. It has to be eaten in one house. So you can't take the meat out of your house. It has to be eaten in one room in one house. So you stay in one place. The groups are created that unifies Jews. You create groups. Everyone's unifying together. You don't just kind of randomly pick up on different sacrifices. We have to make unified groups to eat the sacrifice. The animal which is brought for the sacrifice, we said it could be a lamb or a sheep, but the Torah says it should be within its first year of life. So it has to be within the first year. That's also the idea of one. It can't. It's not in the second year of life. It's the first year of life. If it's older, if it's beyond 1 year, then you can't use it for the sacrifice. So it's also an idea of being one. The animal is roasted whole. When you roast the Karam Pesach, you don't chop it up beforehand. Halach is you have to roast it all together as one. So again, it's one. You don't break the bones, you leave it as one. If you start breaking bones, so then you have lots of pieces. You don't break the bones, you leave all the bones together. He actually gives some other examples as well, but we see that all these different halachas suggest the idea of one. So why are we focusing in on the number one? It's because we're trying to profess that God is one, His people are one, and part of Pesach is to bring that all together, is to reject pagan ideals, focus in on the one and only God, and to unify as Jewish people to come together and reflect God's light. That's the goal of Pesach. That's the goal of what it means to be a Jew.
Yeah, you're going to probably get to this.
Yeah.
The shankbone on the Seder plate, is that representing the sacrifice?
Yeah, so that reminds us of the sacrifice.
The shankbone.
Yeah. We can get to that in a minute. But the, yeah.
The shank, if I'm high, usually they give me a broken piece. Right. They don't give me a whole bone when I ask for a bone.
Right, it's a good point.
Is that all right?
I mean, there's no halacha that it has to be a whole bone in terms of the shank bone on the Seder plate. Cause it's just to remember the sacrifice. It's not actually the sacrifice. But I guess you'd remember it better if it was a whole bone. So, you know, maybe it'd be a nice thing to have a whole bone. So the roots of our relationship with God are that we reject paganism, we reject polytheism, we reject any of these practices. Our whole service of God is based on the unity of God, the unity of His people, being one, focusing on God as one. Everything in the world comes from God. Pesach, the Seder, is a time where we have to focus on this. Pesach is the night where the relationship is, it begins. The relationship with God begins on Pesach. Historically, the Exodus was where the Jewish people and God first had their first rendezvous. And every year we recall that on Pesach, the Seder night, the first night of Pesach, at the Seder, that rendezvous, we have that rendezvous once again. We initiate the relationship with God. And when we initiate the relationship, it has to be that God is one, we are one, and we profess the fact that we are devoted to the one and only God. There's one other point I want to get to, and then we can discuss the Seder plate and some more practical parts of this. As I mentioned before, the mitzvah of the karban came along with eating matzah and maror together with it. The way the Torah phrases these mitzvahs, we'll talk about matzah and maror as weeks go on as well. But the way the Torah presents to us the mitzvah of the Karam Pesach, it's that you eat the matzah and the bitter herbs with the karban. And it happens to be, nowadays, when we don't have the karban, the eating of the bitter herbs is only a rabbinic obligation. It's not a biblical obligation.
But the bitter herbs?
The bitter herbs, yeah. In the times of the sacrifice, there is a Torah obligation to eat the bitter herbs. Without the sacrifice, it gets bumped down to rabbinic obligation. But we see that the matzah and the maror, they are part and parcel of the karban. That's how the Torah presents these mitzvahs to us. So the Maral says a very deep message. The Maral tells us that, you know, matzah represents freedom. We talk about that was the bread they ate as they were freed. And
bread of affliction.
Well, bread of affliction, that represents the affliction. But it's also looked at as the bread of freedom. I can't remember the term I'm trying to think of. But it's also called the bread of freedom. And at the Seder, matzah represents the bread of freedom. That's what we eat as we left Egypt. Bitter herbs represent tough times in life, suffering, the bitter times in life. But the Karban Pesach represents the fact that God is one. And when we eat it all together, we're proclaiming that the good things and the bad things all come from God. The bitter herbs are connected to God, and so are the matzah. It's also connected to God, because you have to eat it all together. And the Maral says, it's an important message. When we talk about God being one, what does it mean that God is one? So on our level, one thing it means is that all events in the world stem from God. We don't say, well, the good things come from God and the bad things come from somewhere else. That's not a Jewish belief. We believe that even things that we perceive as tragic or bad or suffering, those also stem from God. It's also part of God's plan. So eating the matzah and the maror with the Karma Pesach is reinforcing that message, that the freedom comes from God, but the bitterness also came from God. The slavery also was part of God's plan as well. Slavery didn't come from some other source. There is no other source. God is the source of everything in this world. And that's the message. So the eating of this karban, eating it was a very powerful experience. There was so much symbolism and so much spirituality that came along with it. We're lacking that nowadays. But the way that we tap into sacrifices nowadays is by reflecting upon the concepts. The rabbis tell us, if you read about a sacrifice, it's as if you brought it. So many people have the practice of in the morning at Shacharis to recite the sacrifices, the karbanos. And the reason we do that is because if we recite the words describing the karbanos, it's as if we brought the karban. That's
so
the rabbis tell us.
And so we read about the sacrifice at Shacharis that morning?
Yeah. So I mean, a lot of shuls actually skip over it. But if you look in your siddur at the very beginning, there's probably about 20 pages.
Oh, every morning at Shacharis.
Yeah, every morning at Shacharis. Yeah, right. It's probably about 20 pages in the siddur which describe the sacrifices. Again, most shuls do skip those pages, but the reason they're there is because if one does recite the description of the sacrifices, it's as if we brought the sacrifice. That's what the Gemara tells us.
So on Pesach, the morning of Pesach.
So on Pesach, so many of the practice.
Will be reading it. I mean, the most shuls will read it that morning. Then is that correct?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. There is a practice to read the description of the Karban Pesach on Erev Pesach in the afternoon. So, like in the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, right before the Seder night. Yeah, right.
Mincha.
Yeah, before Mincha or at Mincha, many have the practice to recite the description of the Karban Pesach. By learning about it, thinking about it, the concepts, the ideals, that's what helps us tap into these things. So we can't practice it, but we can at least tap into the concept behind it. So we can learn it. We can learn the ideas. We can read about the actual procedure of bringing it. And it's as if we brought it ourselves. It's mentioned at the Seder. As Judy and Stan were discussing it before, number one, we have it on our Seder plate. We have the shank bone. And that's supposed to remind us of the fact that there's supposed to be a sacrifice here that we don't have. That's why we put a shank bone on the Seder plate. Additionally, in the actual text of the Haggadah, so one of the things we say is that if one goes through the entire Pesach night and doesn't mention Pesach Matzah Morah, the Pesach sacrifice, matzah and the bitter herbs. We don't mention those ideas, then we haven't done our mitzvah of the Seder. And there's a description in the Haggadah itself about the mitzvah of Karban Pesach. So when we get to that point in the Haggadah, we talk about the Karban, and we mention it. But that's part of what we're supposed to discuss at the Seder, is this Karban, because that is a primary part of the Exodus, primary part of the Seder, primary part of the message we're supposed to give over to ourselves and to our children and to those who are around us. So that's all part of the practical ways that we remember the sacrifice are through the shank bone and through discussing it at our Seder. But the mitzvah itself, and I'll just close with this, the mitzvah itself is looked at, like I mentioned before, as one of the primary mitzvahs in the Torah. We're lacking, we can't do it. But it's such a primary mitzvah because it represents really the foundations of what it means to be a Jew. Monotheism, the fact that we're the chosen people, the fact that God is one, that God's people are one, these are the fundamentals of Judaism. And it's all represented by this sacrifice. So every single Jew had to be there in the temple offering the sacrifice on Erev Pesach. The Torah even says, well, what's going to happen? Every single Jew is going to come to the temple, and the borders are going to be protected. Everyone's going to come. The enemies are going to invade Israel. And God promises, don't worry, when everyone comes to the temple, I'm going to take care of the land. That's what God says. There's a promise in the Torah that when everybody comes to the temple for the holidays, God will protect the land of Israel. So even though all the Jews who are on the border are going to go into Jerusalem, the land will be safe. That's the guarantee we have from God on Pesach. But that was this karban. So you picture the scene of the Jews all coming together, everybody with this sacrifice, everyone proclaiming the unity and in their devotion to God. It's an incredible scene. So we just think about that and let it impact us. It's an important message of Pesach. Yeah.
But does that protection go for Yom Kippur also?
Well, for Yom Kippur, not everyone was obligated to go into Jerusalem. So probably not. The obligation was only on the Shosh Regalim, the three pilgrimage holidays, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. On Yom Kippur, there was a lot happening in the temple, but the Jews didn't have to be there. The Kohen had to be there, but not the Jews. So I would assume the guarantee doesn't apply then, but I don't know. Any other questions?
Wow, this is awesome. Thank you.